Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another one of our very entertaining podcasts with me, Simon, and him, Mark.
And on today's podcast, we're going to have reviews of Made in Dagenham, Buried, the Ryan Reynolds movie in which Ryan Reynolds is buried, Little Big Soldier, the new Jackie Chan movie, and more.
I'm particularly looking forward to a conversation with Stephen Woolley, I think, a little bit later on.
The producer of Made in Dagenham, who will be complaining that his film should not be a 15 certificate, but a 12 certificate.
It's the programme that can basically expand to fill the available space. And the available space that appears to us is between now and 4 o'clock, as, you know, traditionally placed, really.
Yeah, unless everything suddenly dries up spectacularly. But they're not. No, they've said they're not.
No announcement till four.
Oh, that means that they can't start playing. So we've definitely got till four.
And Stephen Woolley is going to be speaking to us later.
Yes, we think so. He's even as we speak, hot foot to a studio in Bristol.
Because
he lives near Bristol.
Yeah, but why are we talking?
Oh, because, well, he's. I don't know whether you've seen the paper today, but his film Made in Dagenham
the paper.
But there has been. He has written a piece complaining that it's been given a 15 certificate for liberal use of the F word. He insists.
Well, that's why it's got a 15 certificate then.
Yes, you have this out with him. I'm just laying the background. I'm not having the argument, Simon. I'm just.
He thinks
explaining.
It should be a 12.
He thinks it should be a 12 because he thinks that everyone should be able to see the movie, and but I will allow him to defend himself.
So we'll do that later. You can get in touch, of course, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Bill, somewhere near Cambridge. I don't know if you remember, but I emailed last week to ask if you could play nicely for once. I think you ignored me. All that stuff about prepositions was just disgraceful. How about a real go at better behaviour this week? You have a responsibility to the kids. Think of the example you're setting. We could soon be swamped by a generation of bickering young people with a disturbingly deep knowledge of terrible movies and expensive hair products. We did a bit.
Yeah. I got given, I haven't got it right here to my hand, I'll grab it in a moment. Something, a fellow critic came up to me in a screening and said, "Oi, on that subject of never use a preposition to end a sentence with, here is a leaflet explaining to you why that is a complete affectation and why you have no right to say it." And I've got it, I will read it out between now and the end of the show. What it's saying is that anyone who says that you cannot use a preposition to end a sentence with is essentially being stuffy and old-fashioned, and language is correct through usage and split infinitives as you will.
Nigel Ridpath
it's
in Horsham,
nonsense, incidentally.
As a listener who physically grimaces every time Dr. K uses the term "get given," I was astonished to hear him chastising his audience vis-a-vis a preposition placement. "He who is without sin," etc.
Is that the sound of glass houses crumbling? When
indeed.
Do I use "get given"?
Quite a lot.
Do I? Give me an example of a sentence in which I'd use "get given."
"Dear 75 and 3, it being a magic number, I'm just listening to last week's show on the iPlayer. Having had Marmaduke pass me by completely, I stopped to find the trailer on YouTube to see how bad it could possibly be. Having watched it, could I ask the good doctor whether any trailer with a dancing sequence, unless dancing is integral to the plot, has ever been any good? Incidentally, 75 has just loudly announced that he'd like his listeners to speak proper English. I was under the impression that the correct phrasing is
speak English properly. I think we did cover the speak English properly. There's an interesting thing to be said about Marmaduke. It's only one interesting thing. I was saving it for the top 10, but can I tell you now?
All right.
Okay. So Marmaduke, which is a use certificate film described in the BBC.
No, actually, wait until it's... Because it's in the 10. So wait, when we get to number 10...
That's why I said I was saving it till the top 10.
Well,
the clue was in what I said.
"Dear Mr. Potato Head," says Tom, "and Mrs. Potato Head, my girlfriend has recently gone backpacking around Vietnam with a friend and left me alone in Kentish Town as I couldn't afford the plane ticket."
Sorry, isn't that a song by Morrissey? "My girlfriend's gone backpacking in Vietnam and I'm left at home in Kentish Town."
Tom, I don't think that relationship is going anywhere, really.
It's going to Vietnam.
Well, no, he's just, you know, girlfriend would rather go to Vietnam with girlfriend rather than with Tom. Which he says, "which films made in the Far East would you recommend I watch so that I can feel like I'm there and don't feel boring for not just maxing out my credit card and going with her?"
Well, there's a whole range of Vietnam movies.
Well, give
movies,
me one.
I mean, Apocalypse Now or you know,
okay,
Full
you
Metal Jacket, but I don't... But Full Metal Jacket...
Honey, I feel as though I was with you, I watched Full Metal Jacket.
Here's what you do. You go to the Isle of Dogs and you say, "Honey, I feel that I'm with you," because the Isle of Dogs doubled for that area in Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, despite the fact that in every frame it actually looked like the Isle of Dogs.
Ian in Liverpool Just wanted to let you know that Of Time in the City is available on iPlayer until Sunday the 3rd of October, I know Simon was especially keen to see this fine film.
Yeah, have you seen it yet?
I'm looking forward to catching up with it on iPlayer, because a black and white film about Liverpool is really just what I want. Mm.
Well, the interesting thing about that phrase, Simon, is it demonstrates just how much a one-sentence summary of a movie can completely fail to capture the magical essence of cinema.
I was quoting you.
I don't believe I ever said that it was a black and white documentary about Liverpool. What I said was it was a lyrical peon to the childhood of Terence Davis, who remains one of our most visionary filmmakers, and it's shocking that he doesn't get funded more often.
Robert in Edinburgh, although it's been outside your top 10 for a few weeks now, it is well worth pointing out that Inception has recently overtaken The Da Vinci Code, 2012, and most importantly, Transformers, in the worldwide box office. Does this prove Jesse Birdsall's point about cinema audiences being more intelligent than the film companies take them for being?
It does. I mean, there's a really interesting thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, which is that if you look at the list of the top 10, maybe top 20 most expensive movies of all time, which is a list which is currently, if you adjust for inflation, topped by, on the one hand, Cleopatra from 1963, and on the other hand, Pirates of the Caribbean Part 3 at World's End, both of which, in current current parlance, work at round about the $300 million mark. It's very hard to find a recent example of a really expensive movie that has lost money. What that proves is that whether the movie is good or bad, if you spend a certain amount of money, you have stars in it, and you make it a kind of blockbuster event movie, the film will take money. In which case, why make bad movies? What Christopher Nolan has demonstrated with Inception is the whole idea that if every single person in the cinema doesn't understand every single line of dialogue at the moment that it's said, the movie will tank, is total nonsense. Interestingly enough, when Titanic made its money, one of the things that made it so successful was that people went to see the film more than once because, you know, people loved those characters. And I concede that that's true. They were wrong, but there we go. In the case of Inception, there's a level of repeat viewing which has happened because people loved the fact that the first time around they didn't quite get it. And they went to see it again to see how it all tied up. Now, that is a brilliant example of the public demanding films being challenging, demanding that a film ask them to go the extra mile, and saying, you know what, if I have to see the film twice, happily do so, because you're treating me like a grown-up, not you're treating me like an imbecile who feels that every minute some Basil Exposition character has to come out from centre stage and say, incidentally, for those of you in the back row who aren't following, on a ship, it's hit
this.
An iceberg, it's going to sink, and this is where they met. Good.
Yeah, we got that about 10 minutes ago. Interesting piece from Michael Caine this week. He was on...
Michael Caine?
He was on Chris Moore's programme, Radio 1. And he's just talking about Inception.
Has he been paid?
He says if he's in it... Because there's a lot of speculation about the end of Inception.
Yeah.
He said, if I'm in it...
It's not a dream. Well, if he's in that bit, it's not a dream.
He said, if I'm in it, it's not a dream. Period.
Yeah, but that's rather like the thing that when Willem Dafoe came on here and I said Antichrist is a film about misogyny, and he said no, it's not. And I said, well, you only think that because you made the film. I've actually seen it. Just because Michael Caine's in Inception doesn't mean he understands it.
I think it does.
Hold on. Is it a dream? Do you think it's a dream?
If Michael says
no, don't do the if. Do you think it's a dream?
I don't want to spoil it.
I don't think it'll be spoiled by you letting people know what you think.
I don't think people... Because this all boils down to whether the twiddly thing falls or whether the twiddly thing doesn't fall. And I think we could be in Dumbledore territory.
I think we have to go and see the film again just to check it out and to put it back into the top 10.
What can we say about it? I think there is observable erosion in its spinning, which tells you all you need to know. Happy?
I'm just thrilled that you just used the phrase observable erosion.
Has Mark heard, says Christian, the wonderful news that Star Wars is to be re-released in 3D? Quite a number of emails on this. Won't this be the ultimate cinematic experience? And is he, like me, counting off the days until he can put those goggles on and be amazed as the Imperial Cruiser rumbles overhead? Blue touch paper well and truly lit, now standing back from exploding radio. Also on this, Phil in Huddersfield, do you think the release of the Star Wars series in 3D will overcome the problems in the 2D versions? Surely it can't make Jar Jar Binks any worse.
The interesting thing about news that George Lucas is going back to remaster the entire Star Wars series in 3D is, firstly, it's good because, frankly, I don't think he's exploited those movies enough. I mean, I think they could be a real little earner for him, and I'm glad to see that he's finally learnt to exploit them. Second thing is, retrofitted 3D, or as a correspondent a couple of weeks ago pointed out, dimensionalized 3D, to give it its proper term,
yes,
is the modern equivalent of colorization. Elvis Costello once said, have you ever seen a colorized movie? It's like watching a black and white movie on a television that some kid has scribbled all over with crayons. Now, if George Lucas thinks little enough of his own work that he thinks, I must go back and turn it into 3D because there's, you know, somehow it was artistically lacking the first time around, great. I think what Lucas actually thinks is, you know what? We haven't squeezed any money out of the Star Wars franchise for the last 5 minutes. We better do that. Meanwhile, James Cameron, who's going around complaining that the 3D revolution is being undermined by the level of retrofitted 3D, is hard at work retrofitting Titanic into 3D. Do we think that's because he thinks the story wasn't told well enough the first time around? In which case, James, I'm with you. Or do we think it's because he thought, you know what? I could make it the third biggest selling movie of all time after the other two that I've just made by re-releasing it. It's like the Avatar Special Edition. Why?
I would go and see Star Wars in 3D. I know what you're going to say, but I just know that, first of all, it would annoy you.
Which bit's going to be better? Yeah, that's why you do it.
Well, you know that the very opening sequence bit, where the thing rumbles from the foreground into the background?
Yeah, because it looks so much better with that fantastic quality that 3D has of making everything look little. Everything look little. The real triumph, incidentally, of that opening sequence is they've got a model, and because of the way it's shot, they've made it look massive. You do it in 3D, it'll look little.
I know.
It'll look like you're looking at a little Airfix model. Oh, look, I wonder who's in there. That Death Star, it's the size of a football. It's like watching an intergalactic snooker match with a little football going like that. That's what it'll do.
We're late for the travel, but John Inverdale was late handing over at 2 o'clock and he had no golf to talk about, but he was still late. And I just want to do this. Simon and Exeter, hello, not listed in a newspaper for the larger-handed man and Lindsay Hipgrave's hype man, like what rappers have, says Simon and Exeter. You know which you are? You're the latter. I love this show, but I now catch myself saying hello to Jason Isaacs when I see his name on screen. I was watching the new animated Batman movie in which his voice features, I said hello to his voice when his name appeared in the opening credits. No doubt I'll be doing the same when I see his name pop up at the start of the new Castlevania video game.
Yeah.
Now, there's a thing. Say hello to the Jaster. Saying hello to the Jaster has become my kind of Tourette's.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK cinema top 10.
5 Live.
Box office top 10. Here we go with reviews imminent. Well, not, you know, to be honest, in about half an hour. At 10, it's Marmaduke. Now's your moment to do your story.
The film's rubbish, but you certificate film. And on the BBFC classification, I just noticed this because there's been a lot of stuff recently about film classification, film censorship. Stephen Woolley will be talking about it a little bit later on. As you probably know, there was problems recently with certification of I Spit in Your Grave and a Serbian movie. Marmaduke is a youth certificate film, which fell foul of the BBFC. It was passed you for, the adventure of a Great Dane dog who moves to California with the owners, tries to make friends. It was passed you for scenes of mild threat, but was cut by 2 seconds in order to remove an offensive word, which was an offensive slang word that's offensive to, I suppose, disabled people. And they were told that they could have a 12 certificate with it, or they could cut it out, and they cut it out. I mean, it's interesting. I do tend to feel that when you pass...
So straight from you, it's you or 12?
It was you or 12, yeah. PG wasn't an option either. So they took it out and they replaced it with another word, rather, because it says substitution. Substitution means you keep the running time the same, but you just change the... But it's interesting. I mean, the BBFC do take this stuff very seriously, and so used to forget, but cut.
So that's my Tomorrow Dew's at 9. A Neil in Woking. I took spouse to see Tomorrow Dew in continued search for the film we might both enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Only a limited success. Problem is that half of the characters are intensely irritating because of their selfish malevolence, while the other half are equally annoying because of their passivity and timidity in the face of all this maltreatment. Only one well-rounded character in the whole thing, the English countryside. Sometimes sunny, idyllic and expansive, at other times tedious, muddy and claustrophobic. The film meanders through the first hour while director strives vainly to stir up our empathy for someone or anyone. Only after all this huffing and puffing is the point revealed as an old-style morality tale.
Well, I agree entirely. I mean, as I said, I haven't read the original, though people tell me that the Posey Simmons has a lot of that ambiguity in it. When I saw it, my feeling was that they didn't know what kind of film it was. And again, to be clear about this, I'm not saying the problem with the film is that you can't pigeonhole it. What I'm saying is that in order for the film to work, the people who made it need to know what they're making. And I didn't get the sense of this is a disparate mishmash of styles because we've designed it that way. I got the sense that they didn't really know what film it was they were doing until they got into the editing room, and about halfway through the editing they went, oh, you know what? It's broadly speaking a comedy. And it, I'm still baffled by the level of critical adulation that it's had.
Resident Evil is at number 8. Resident Evil, colon, Afterlife.
Afterlife. Yet another in the Paul W.S. Anderson series. Very little to say about the film itself, other than it's yet another one of his stories. This time, Mila Jovovich lands in a building. She has to get from the building to a ship. But meanwhile, the zombie griblies are coming up through the floor. It's 3D, and Paul Anderson has made a lot of fuss about how it's in, you know, it was shot in 3D. It was designed to be in 3D. It's meant to be in 3D. The cameras were designed by NASA. Still looks like hokey 3D to me.
Grown Ups at 7.
Oh, yes, still haven't seen Grown Ups. Oh, no, I did see Grown Ups. I saw Grown Ups 2 weeks ago.
Have you seen it all?
I have. It's the Adam Sandler movie. God, that's how much, right? I paid to see it on an afternoon. Boring. I mean, but what I had the feeling of when I saw it was, because I had to take a punt on seeing, I was trying to catch up with the things that were in the top 10 that I thought would still be in the top 10 the next week. And what I felt was, I don't get Adam Sandler comedies. I don't understand why people think this is heartwarming. I don't understand why people think this is funny. And it was instantly forgettable. There's a movie coming out this week which is almost more forgettable, but instantly forgettable.
Toy Story 3 at 6.
Never forgettable. Unforgettable. Okay. That's what you are, unforgettable. Although I think both you and I are agreed that the 3D version isn't necessary. That the 2D...
It's not offensive. And you just think, well, what's the point?
Well, because you forget you're watching a 3D film.
Yeah, so no point then.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to The Hole, which we'll get to, where you're constantly reminded that you are watching.
Yeah.
Devil at 5.
So, again, in the catching up on the films I hadn't seen, so went to see Devil at the Shepherd's Bush.
Don't need to know where you saw it.
I just thought it'd be interesting background information.
Well, let's judge it. You went to see it where, then? Shepherd's Bush?
Shepherd's Bush. Cinema.
Okay. In what Shepherd's way does
Bush.
That help
I was just giving you background information. Do you want to hear what I thought about it?
It would be nice.
Okay. I have a thing about lifts, right? I don't like lifts. I got stuck in a lift when I was a kid once, and I don't like lifts. I'm slightly claustrophobic about lifts. Incidentally, coming up later in the show, buried. And so the film Devil, which is a story by M. Night Shyamalan, opens up with this thing which says the Night Chronicles, which suggests that there's going to be a whole series of these, not directed by M. Night Shyamalan, though. And story is, a bunch of people get into a lift, lift gets stuck. One of them may or may not be the devil. The lights keep going
off. Which
one
is it?
Well, the funny thing is, here's the challenge, right? 10 minutes into the film, the lift gets stuck, right? If you can't pick which one it is, you're not trying. And
is it that obvious?
Well, both me and the person I saw it with, the person with whom I saw it...
Yes.
Both the person with whom I saw it and I think to be correct, both went, that's it.
It's the bloke with horns.
it's like a 30-minute Twilight Zone episode stretched out over 90 minutes. It's not terrible. It's just terribly uninteresting.
OK, now the whole 3D is at number 4. Bunch of correspondence on this.
Is it a whole bunch of correspondence?
Keith Everett, aged 41 and 2 days. Please read this as a warning to others. For my birthday treat, my wife and I took my children, 12 and a half and 10 and a half, funny names, to see The Hole. I knew it was a horror, but the cinema magazine said it would be liked by people who appreciated Aliens in the Attic, The Vampire's Assistant, and so on.
Vampire's Assistant was not a good adaptation of those books, incidentally.
Both my kids coped with these films, failing to find one scary or disturbing.
Yeah, but...
However... This is a useful thing. Yeah,
no, I agree. Because I had the same dilemma.
The Hole left them traumatised, and we had to leave the cinema when the undead waif started bleeding from her eyes and moaning, "I don't want to die." I don't think either of them has slept since, and cannot recall Ashley Tisdale suffering anything nearly as visceral in that rubbish attic film.
Monsters
this
in the
movie
attic.
Has more in common with The Ring or The Grudge than any kids' film I can think of. Definitely one for hardened teens. Then he concludes, and I'm cleaning this up.
Really?
My son, says Keith, who never swears, well, not in front of the family anyway, was overheard telling his granny, "I was so scared I nearly pooped myself." A bit crude, I know, but funnier than anything Adam Sandler has ever said.
Exactly.
Imagine saying that to your granny.
I know. Well, the funny thing about this is, firstly, the reference to Ringu is, of course, very sensible, because the apparition, the child apparition that you're talking about, does seem to me to have been filmed in reverse, which is the technique they use in The Ring for when Sadako comes out of the well, and they film it back to, it looks like that's, they're using the walking technique. And, of course, Joe Dante, who's very cine-literate, would know all about that. The other thing is, I mean, I thought the stuff that was really creepy was the stuff with the clown doll, because I've got a thing about clowns anyway, along with lifts.
Blimey.
And I've got so many phobias, so little time
to get worked
and
up about.
My son, who's 9, really wanted to go and see the hole, and I had to say, actually, no, because I think it's too scary. And I'm glad that was it. What I did was, we went instead to see...
The Exorcist?
Thank you. No, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which unfortunately now is not in the top 10. It's dropped out. But can I just say, was really good and much better than either of us expected. And he loves the book and the books. And he said it was really, really close to the books. And he really, really enjoyed it. But I had to draw the line and say, no, you know what? 9 is too young for the whole. And frankly, it may well be that 12 is too young for the whole. It is certainly, and we made this comparison before, you know, Vanishing is a 12 certificate movie, would creep anyone out. The whole is a scary film, and the stuff with the kid is scary. Yeah. The stuff with the clown is scary. The stuff with the hole is scary. It's a horror film for 12 and upwards, I would say, but certainly take an under 12 year old under advisement.
Advisement.
Yeah, as I was getting towards the end of that sentence, I was wondering what that word was. Is it under advice? That's wrong grammar. Is serving me well.
Yes.
PhD in English. I blame declining educational standards.
Robert Hancock says, although the English dubbed subbed version of Now Onibaba,
the hole,
may have the hole as catch copy, Onibaba does not mean the hole. The Japanese kanji in the title are Oni, meaning devil, and Baba, meaning hag.
Woman. Hag.
So it means devil hag. The Japanese also have another word for witch, which apparently is mayo.
Is it? So Oni mayo?
Apparently.
Several people tweeted this. Yes, the Onibaba, the English title of that film is The Hole, Onibaba the Hole, but apparently, and I didn't know this, Onibaba does mean demonic hag. It does not mean hole, and I apologise to everybody for getting that wrong.
And Dave Roberts in Suffolk says, I was interested to hear Mark recommend this obscure Japanese film on last week's programme as one of the scariest movies ever made.
It really is.
I took his advice and looked up Onibaba. I couldn't quite believe that anything made in black and white in 1964 was really going to do the job, but Dr. K is always right, is he not? So I went ahead and rented the DVD. I watched it last night and frankly thought it was about as scary as a glass of milk. Maybe I misheard the title and rented the wrong movie. If not, can the good doctor please explain why a film featuring lots of long grass swaying in the wind and not much else is so good?
Honestly, if you don't know why long grass swaying in the wind with the demonic...
Does that scare you as well, along with clowns and lifts?
I am a walking barrel of phobias. Onibaba is... And somebody else wrote in saying, it's not Onibaba, it's Onibaba. Onibaba would be a story about a demon elephant.
One underreported problem here, we will get to news and sport very shortly, but because John Inverdale was late handing to us, it means that all our...
he had so much
golf to report, all our preparation... Yeah.
We just shunted on a bit, that's all right.
Craig in Glasgow, last week's show spent a long time talking about grammar. My grammar is good, so I didn't find Mark's pedantry irritating. I wondered if Mark has strong views on manners. When I was brought up, in addition to good grammar, my mum taught me manners. An example of such manners is not eating with one's mouth full. Consequently, it
not
really annoys me.
Eating with one's mouth full?
That's what he says.
Eating with one's mouth full.
I think he probably means speaking, but he's written eating. Consequently, it really annoys me when people eat with their mouths full. He keeps on saying it. I have hung up on the phone on people who have phoned me and then proceeded to eat. During the clip of The Hole in 3D, the characters were eating and talking, and this really grated with me. And I hope you can choose clips in future that avoid bad manners.
Okay.
So I think that's when you're choosing the clips of the film, which we'll come to with our reviews, are there any cases of bad manners being shown?
I can't think off the top of my head that there are.
Craig, thank you. You slightly confused everyone with your email, but I think we cleared it up. Sean in Liverpool, because we've in the top 10, we're at the number 3, which is The Town.
Yes.
Sean went to see it. He said, after Gone Baby Gone had surpassed my expectations of what Ben Affleck could do behind the camera, I was looking forward
to what was being billed as this year's must-see heist movie. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, after an engaging first few scenes, the film degenerated into the most simple paint-by-numbers plot possible, and unlike the incompetent FBI agents, I could see everything coming a mile away. The film is littered with huge, glaring plot holes. There is nothing original in any of the characters or their stories, and there seems to be a competition to see who can produce the worst possible accent, with Pete Postlethwaite taking the distinction, moving between Irish, Northern Irish and Scottish.
I mean, it is a terribly ordinary film, which is odd because it sort of comes at you looking like an awards contender, and certainly there have been reviews on the poster which seem to think it's really glowing and extraordinary. I mean, it's not. There are things in it that are fairly well handled, but it is, in the end, fairly ordinary. And at its best moments, it nods toward other films, such as the shootout sequence from Heat, which just reminds you how much better those other films are. It's not terrible, but it's not anything to write home about.
Eat, Pray, Love is at number two. Or Fear,
Desperation and Murder.
Dear Tony and Marilyn, this is Hannah in Battersea. I went to see Fear, Desperation and Murder last Saturday night as a last-ditch measure towards reconciliation after this friend had not spoken to me for 3 months. Just like the book, the film was pretentious and interminable, leaving you feeling neither uplifted nor even with a desire to visit the three countries depicted. I fear that it may be at least another 3 months before the friend speaks to me again. Warren in Leeds...
Excuse me.
I wish to comment on the amazing soporific powers of the good doctor. My six-month-old son was crying his eyes out and wouldn't sleep, so like many parents, we turned to a long drive to try and calm him down, with last week's podcast as a trusty companion. After an hour of the finest entertainment failing to calm the boy, I was at my wit's end, but then Mark's review of Eat, Pray, Love came on. Almost instantly, the boy stopped crying to listen to the Commodian rant as it built up steam and promptly fell asleep immediately afterwards. Is there any chance of getting a collection of strands? Lullaby. I've never thought of it as a lullaby thought,
no.
But there you go.
Don't people generally play whale song, you know, as a lullaby
yes,
thing?
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or Mozart.
No, but the Wiggles definitely.
Stephen, on his way to Oktoberfest, having heard the Fear, Desperation, Murder review on the podcast, I feel compelled to write in answer to your question about whether or not British people ever get fucked up. Just one thing.
Valentine was the example.
Yes, I don't believe I've ever set out with that purpose, but on occasion I have experienced a blissful sense of calm, which I suspect might be associated with the achievement. Once or twice, only at a time when I'm away from my job and free from stresses of day-to-day life. I've pondered this matter and I've concluded that we Britons don't go away to find ourselves, but go on holiday, which has much the same effect, probably involves fewer parrots. I asked the good doctor to note the correct use of fewer rather than less.
So
that's what we do. We just go on holiday.
Can I say just this, Robbie, this is a book.
Who gave it to you?
The film critic.
Who's Robbie the film critic?
Robbie Collin. He was the person who gave this to me. He's a friend of James King's and he gave this
is
to
he?
Me.
Okay.
He said, you might want this. It's a book about the idea of not using a preposition to end sentence with. Today, happily, this is universally condemned as a pointless affectation. And then on the subject of speech and split infinitive is a thing of beauty, but it's certainly no worse than some of the excruciating constructions foisted on readers by those who regard it with an almost pathological dread. Thank you for that. I don't give that advice anyway. Neither do you split an infinitive.
My point, which I return to,
entirely,
was not about pedantry, which I hold aboard. Final comment on Eat, Pray, Love from David in Frankfurt. Is it just me, or does the title Eat, Pray, Love sound like an advertisement tagline for Hope?
Good.
Which is interesting.
You were particularly pleased by that joke, weren't you? You gave me the dictionary definition
email.
Of a... No, it's a great email,
that's
but afterwards
email.
Viewers would have to go, it's got the expression on his face. I read that joke.
From a clever listener.
It's like your face was worth 1,000 words. Not that face.
Right, and the number one is The Other Guys. The Other Guys.
It's Mark Wahlberg's the best thing about The Other Guys. I like Mark Wahlberg very much. I think he's actually a very fine actor, although he's been in some films that are not very fine. He's certainly the funniest thing in the film. I still have the Will Ferrell comedy bypass. There are movies in which he is funny. Zoolander, he's funny in. That's kind of it, really, isn't it?
Luke Owen says, all the other class night, I thought it was pretty funny. Not as funny as it thinks.
No, certainly not as funny.
What
as
was
it
great about my viewing visit was that my housemate and I were the only people in the cinema, which meant no mobile phones, no talking, no popcorn, just cinema bliss. How about this, though? Here's Ian in Bolton on a text. Because we're discussing the whole and the kind of people who would, kind of kids who would enjoy going to see it. I took my 13-year-old to see The Hole. He loved 28 Days Later, but thought The Hole terrifying. So now let's work out
let's
how
work
old 13-year-old son. What? So 28 Days Later is what, 4 years?
Yeah, but presumably he saw it on DVD, okay. So he could have seen it when he
Anytime.
Was 13.
So let's assume he's 13.
Yeah.
That's still a bit young, don't you think?
It is. To the best of my
memory...
Isn't
it an 18?
It's a 15 or an 18. There's some tough stuff in that film. I mean, you know, 28 Days, and then the sequel is even tougher.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Ian didn't text in to get his parenting qualities examined and trashed. I'm just doing it anyway.
So you... Get me for picking up on listeners' grammar.
Yes.
You, on the other hand, go straight to the heart of
telling
insulting their parenting standards.
Yes.
Now, tell me, do you think a listener will be more offended by having their grammar corrected or by
their
having
parenting
their parenting
skills.
Corrected? I think, frankly, you are on a hiding to nothing, sonny boy.
Would you think 28 Days Later... I mean, it's interesting because, okay, so look, 28 Days Later, not as scary as The Hole. I think most people would probably put 28 Days Later as more disturbing than The Hole, but it's an interesting indicator as to where you should be thinking of placing this film.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with The Hole, because it's PG-13 in America, 12 over here, what that indicates is that it's not a film which is laden with visceral gore, it's not a film which is going for splatter shocks. I mean, there are some visual images in it that are very disturbing. The one that the previous listener mentioned of the, you know, of the bloody walking child figure, which is creepy and does walk like Sadako out of the Ringu films, but what Dante has done with it is to deliberately rein himself in, and that has made him make a movie which is creepy and, you know, genuinely ghostly. And I would refer you once again to Onibaba saying that it's not a film. I mean, Kaneto Shinda was perfectly
All
able
that
to
swaying
to make...
grass in black and white. Look out! The swaying grass is going to sway. And
have you ever seen
you
The Pit and
bit?
The Pendulum?
And the pendulum just sways from one side
to the
other.
No, but you know, it's possible for films which work purely on suggestion to be really, really scary. You know that.
I do indeed. David in Winchester, following up from the previous listener's email on the subject of good manners, is there a chance that Dr. Kermode could stop interrupting listeners' emails?
Mm-hmm. It's unlikely.
Damien Stevenson. Regarding manners, it was drilled into me as a boy that it was the height of disrespect to
interrupt
someone
people.
Else while they are speaking.
Yeah, but you know the thing...
While Dr. K's interjections are frequently amusing, perhaps it would be worth reminding him that his tendency to do so would have earned him a clip round the ear from my endearingly fearsome grandmother. Thank you. Now you can comment.
Do you know the two bits of advice my dad gave me when I was young? Stop watching all those movies and learn to speak properly.
So you took notice of...
Neither of the above.
Neither. And amongst the releases coming out this weekend, Made in Dagenham. We'll talk to Stephen Woolley later. However, first of all...
So the thing with Made in Dagenham is, as you probably know, the two things to know about it. Firstly, that it's based on or inspired by the true life story of the Ford Dagenham workers' women's strike, which happened at the end of the 60s and led either directly or indirectly, depending on which version of history you'd like to believe, to the Equal Pay Act. So it is a film which is essentially about women going on strike and demanding... A, to be taken seriously and to be seen as skilled workers, and secondly, demanding the fundamental right of equal pay regardless of gender. Okay, which does not perhaps sound like the most frothy and upbeat subject. What's happened is that they've taken this story and turned it into what I think is a genuinely feel-good movie. And we've had discussions on the show before about what feel-good means. I mean, most famously, when Slumdog Millionaire came out, and there was a quote...
Feel-good movie of the decade.
Feel-good movie of the decade, which is, you know, you're sitting there watching this hideous mistreatment of, street kids in Mumbai, thinking, when is this actually going to become the feel-good movie? In the case of Made in Dagenham, it's one of those films that genuinely deserves the feel-good tag, in that you see it... And it makes you feel good. It stars Sally Hawkins, who is basically the working mum who reluctantly becomes the person who is the spearhead of the industrial action. Several other great performances, including Bob Hoskins and Miranda Richardson as Barbara Castle. Here's a clip from the movie, and this isn't incidentally a particularly frothy clip, but here's a clip of the magnificent Miranda Richardson.
I've been following your dispute very closely, and I want to say how proud I am of the battle that you fought. I fully support the struggle for equal pay. And you will have it, but in time.
What?
Industry will object. The Lords will kick up a fuss. The press will have a field day. It's not going to be easy.
Well, what is? What's worth fighting for?
Return to work. Go back to your machines. And you have my word, I will push forward with your fight.
No.
Mrs. O'Grady.
Oh, we need something solid. Something now. You've got the authority. You know, we thought seeing you, we'd...
In politics, you sometimes have to play the long game.
We ain't politicians, we're working women. And so are you.
So, the films that I would compare it to thematically are... You remember Brassed Off,
mm-hmm.
which I loved and I think you loved too.
Great film.
Yeah, which looked on the outside like a movie about brass bands, but was actually a movie that said...
Well, it kind of was a movie about
brass bands. But it was also a movie about Thatcherism and politics in Britain, which it managed to, you know... I think it worked really well. And incidentally, to this day, if I'm driving around, particularly if I'm driving around in Cornwall, the Brassed Off soundtrack goes on because I love the Brassed Off soundtrack. It is a movie about brass bands, but it's about something else. Also, to some extent, it's comparable to The Full Monty, in as much as The Full Monty was a film which was a very British film, a very British story, which had international appeal and ended up being an Oscar contender and being a big hit around the world and inspiring a stage show, which I believe, you know, is running somewhere in the world even now. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Made in Dagenham has exactly the same kind of crossover success for so many reasons. Firstly, it's directed by Nigel Cole, who previously made Calendar Girls, and I think it's a tougher film than Calendar Girls, but what he's understood is that essentially if you want this this story to be seen by a number of people, which they clearly do, you need to make it into something which is as lively, as engaging, as fun, as entertaining as is possible, whilst not losing the central thread of the story, which is that in the end, equal pay is not a privilege, it is a right. And he and Bill Ivory, who wrote the script, have done, I think, a note-perfect job of what I would describe, although I don't think anybody else would, as interest filmmaking. In as you have this story
that
to tell...
That sounds enticing.
It is. You have this story to tell, right? And you have an audience that have these expectations, and you know what? What you do is you combine the two things together in a way which is very, very difficult to do. I mean, people think that somehow it's easy to popularise stories. It's not. It's a balance that you walk along a knife edge. I have now seen Made in Dagenham 3 times. And every time I've seen it, I've thought, you know, the amount that I'm impressed by it goes up, because what it does is it knows exactly how frothy and entertaining and comedic it may be. I mean, I see from other reviews that it is being referred to broadly as a comedy. And certainly if you look at the poster with the picture of Sally Hawkins smiling in the red dress, which is actually a central plot point to the film, it is entertaining, but you never get the sense that what it's doing is selling out its message. You never get the sense that it loses sight of the idea that at the heart of it, there is a really important idea. Now, compare this to Sex and the City 2, which I had a really big complaint about, right? Now, Sex and the City 2 is poisonous.
I remember you loved it.
Yeah, I did. Poisonous, evil, vile, corrosive, generally bad for society, and actually is probably a chipping thing, taking away the foundations of civilization and making us all worse people. In the case of Made in Dagenham, you may think from the outside that if it's a film about this subject, that actually what it would be is the difference between eating, you know, jolly fast food and then eating sort of whole food. This Made in Dagenham is good for you. It's about something. It's got properly written characters, properly developed characters. It has substance. It's a film which you need to see because it's about something genuine. But therefore, obviously, from what you're saying, means it's less fun. No, it's funnier than Sex and the City. It's better played than Sex and the City. It's better written than Sex and the City. I mean, I know slamming your thumb in the car door is more fun than Sex and the City. But the idea that actually, if what you want is a comedy film or an engaging sort of, you know, frothy confection in which you see a whole bunch of women interacting together and leading the drama, and then therefore what you want is Sex and the City too, in which they scream about the right to buy shoes, as opposed to Made in Dagenham. Believe me, the comedy in Made in Dagenham is funny. The drama in Made in Dagenham is engaging. The heartbreaking elements of Made in Dagenham are genuinely heartbreaking. The whole film is made by people who understand that mainstream cinema does not have to be dumb, does not have to be vacuous, does not have to be empty, does not have to have no substance. But what they haven't done is to take the substance and say, fine, well, since we're giving you wholemeal bread, therefore it has to taste like, you know, eating cardboard. I mean, it's a really interesting experiment in a way. How fun and lively and engaging and bright and colourful can you make this story while still keeping the central theme there? And I think if you look back at, for example, something like Calendar Girls, I think this does it much more successfully. Although I do think there are scenes in Calendar Girls that I really like, particularly the very early scenes, which do deal with, you know, tragedy and loss genuinely. It also has a fairly complex narrative which deals not only with the strike, but also with the strike's effect on the striking families, on the, you know, the breakdown of relationships between people within their own families and the toll that going on strike has on those families. It takes... fairly recent, I mean, if you take 1970 as fairly recent, you know, politics, and dramatises in a way which doesn't seem completely cod and yet clearly is, you know, a dramatic invention. And it benefits from the fact that Sally Hawkins has a brilliant performance, which demonstrates to me that all the reservations that I had about a performance in Happy Go Lucky are to do with the material rather than her. I mean, the interesting thing about her is the Happy Go Lucky character I found quite grating. And I think you found the same thing. But didn't you?
Yes.
Fine.
Thank you for including me.
No, it's fine. I just didn't want you to interrupt because that would obviously be bad manners. But what she demonstrates here is that what she's really good at is becoming the role that the part demands, which, of course, is, as we know, the heart of good acting, as opposed to what they think in America, which is the heart of good acting is doing the same performance over and over again and finding vehicles with which to do that. Bob Hoskins is great. Kenneth Cranham is absolutely fantastic. Danny Mays is terrific as the husband. And the whole thing is entertaining and joyous and lively and uplifting in a way that, as I said, I have seen it three times, and every time I've been more impressed by the balancing act that it does. It would not surprise me if this becomes a genuine crossover hit, which I really want it to do. I predict BAFTA nominations, but I think it has the possibility of becoming an Oscar contender. I know that it's a deliberately upbeat, frothy confection, and some people have compared it to the Carry On movies, which either means you're comparing it to the very best of the Carry On movies, which means like things like Carry On Screaming, or you're actually you're downplaying the serious achievements of the film. It is a film about a group of people that you believe in, who have something to say, who are enjoyable to watch, and you come out at the end of it thinking, yes, we can make films like that, and they can be about something, and they can be that much fun, and they can have performances that are that good. I really liked it, and I would be very surprised if at the end of the year it isn't in my top 10 films of the year.
What certificate do you think it should be?
Well, thereby hangs a tale. The film is a 15
certificate. I'm asking you your opinion.
Well, I think that will be preempting the producer coming on and saying...
We can ask him when he's on, but okay. When you watched it, did you think...
It didn't surprise... Here's what I think. It did not surprise me at all that the BBFC gave it a 15 certificate because it features in it language which, under their rulings, is 15 certificate language, in that it uses the F word, I think, something like 16 times.
And is it appropriate, therefore, that it has a 15, in your opinion?
I think in the BBFC's...
I'm asking your opinion. No, don't hold back from your opinion ever. Is this the appropriate certificate or not?
It's the only certificate... I'm trying to be fair to the BBFC whilst being fair to me.
In
personally,
your opinion?
No, OK, fine. In my opinion, I'd show it to my 12-year-old daughter. That's my honest answer to that question. But I understand why the BBFC have done what they've done, which is that in the BBFC's feeling is, if you have that much swearing in a film, it has to be a 15 because parents will complain. I, personally, would be very proud to show that film to my daughter because you know what? I think that's an important, engaging story and I can live with her hearing that word. But I understand why the BBFC have made that decision.
And she probably hears that word around the house anyway.
Never.
Dear Experts, which is always very good, on Dagenham, sounds great.
You made me feel like a squirming politician then. Well, because I'm trying to
asking you your opinion, and yeah, you seem reluctant to give it.
But I'll tell you for why. The reason is because I'm very loath to throw mud at the BBFC without being fair to them, because I think that the BBFC have become a different body to the body they were before. But so my honest answer to that is, personally, I don't have a problem with it, but I understand that other parents would.
Dear Experts, on Dagenham, Miranda Richardson is class. She was brilliant in Dance with a Stranger and really funny on The One Show, which is an unusual phrase, on Wednesday when she was there. As an overexcited presenter gushed about Celtic Manor and the golf, Miranda pretended to be asleep. So, after your own heart. P.S. As Tony Curtis recently passed away, was I'm Spartacus the best two words in the history of cinema?
Nobody's Perfect are probably the best two words in the history of cinema. There was a very funny thing recently that said difference between modern times and past times is in past times he says I'm Spartacus, in modern times everyone would have said he's Spartacus.
How come The Good Doctor, says Colin on the M6, can watch the Dagenham film three times but can't get to see half the films in the top 10?
Yeah, I know.
Well, I'm sorry.
But excuse me, I haven't.
Yes, I know is actually.
I just got through the top 10 and I've seen everything in it.
Eventually.
Yeah, eventually, but it's how I got to eventually. I only saw Made in Dagenham a third time, having seen the other stuff.
Tom in Harrogate, to Scary Clown and Jerky Little Girl, my 11-year-old daughter and I went to see
I'm Jerky
Hole.
Little Girl.
I spent the whole movie getting shivers from the scary clown, whilst my daughter laughed. My daughter is a horror movie nut, so she found it all quite tame, whereas I am still dreading a small toy clown coming to get me, even though I know I should be able to take him.
Go see Devil Doll. That's an oldie but goldie.
What's next?
Buried. And I'm even the thought of having to describe Buried to you is giving me the heebie-jeebies.
You're getting clammy.
Clammy doesn't begin to describe. I nearly had to hold James King's hand, not for his benefit, but for mine.
Nevin Robinson writes, I went to see
Nevin Robinson or Nevin Robinson.
No, Nevin being the first word.
Yeah, I was just checking.
N-E-V-I-N.
Well, Nev is also a word.
I went to see The Illusionist the other night and found it to be an enchanting and very enjoyable movie. Could you advise your listeners, if they intend to see the film, not to leave until after the credits, as there is a little surprise awaiting them, as there was with Belleville Rendezvous? I know Mark has a preference for surrounding himself with empty seats whilst viewing a film. However, can I remind him, when he was in Belfast some months ago...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know where this is going.
...hosting a showing of Local Hero, that my wife Deirdre and I settled down in the seats directly behind him. I tentatively asked if he would sign my Dodge Brothers CD, but as he turned round, he was obviously in some pain, mm-hmm. whereupon my wife gave him a neck massage there and then. Now, my point is, if we'd been two rows behind, you wouldn't have had a massage.
It was the strangest thing. I was sitting in this and I'd wricked my neck. I don't know what I was doing. And I couldn't turn around to do this thing. And this very nice woman said, I'm a sports masseuse or somebody mm-hmm. who deals with that. She said, do you mind if I just... And the next thing I knew, these incredibly powerful thumbs were sorting out the knotty thing in my neck. And it is true that 3 or 4 minutes later, I felt much, much better. And only in Belfast could that happen. That, you sit down and somebody says, you've got a bad neck. Let me fix it for you.
That's an important point to remember, though, that if there is an irritating person who sits right behind you, you could get away that irritation by asking them for an instant massage.
Yeah, and say to them, it's interesting, but kicking the back of my chair isn't making me feel better.
So we can talk Buried. I just want to mention this from Simon Fenton. So I just read the warning attached to the new movie, Buried, Certificate 15, contains violent scenes and sustained death. Is there any other kind? There is either death or this sustained...
I'm just looking behind. Can you print me up the BBFC thing? I must read that. If they are actually using the phrase sustained death, I want to see that.
Is that the first time they've used
I've not heard
phrase?
The phrase sustained death before. I wait until I see it from the BBFC site. Can I tell you about...
Tell me about Buried.
So Buried, new movie, which, as you probably know from the trailer, features Ryan Reynolds...
In a box,
okay. The film opens, black screen, sound of breathing. Lighter comes on. Ryan Reynolds is in a box. It's a coffin. He's under the ground. He has a complete paddy. He's trapped in a box, right? Okay? Now, immediately...
It's not like Boxing Helena.
It's not like Boxing Helena. No, it's not as funny. It doesn't have no Julian Sands. Nothing to do with that. So he's in the box. And he has no light other than his lighter. And then he discovers, down by his feet, a mobile phone... from which he attempts to contact the outside world with varying degrees of success. Here's a clip, and then let me tell you about the experience of watching Buried.
911, please hold.
No! Wait! Yeah.
Yes, 911.
Hello, I'm buried. You have to help me. I can't breathe.
Sir?
I'm buried in a coffin. Please help. Send someone to find me.
Sir, slow down. What is your name?
It's Paul Conroy.
Okay, Mr. Conroy. Can you tell me your location?
I don't know. I'm in a coffin. I don't know where. Please help. I'm scared.
You're in a coffin?
Yes. It's like one of those old wooden ones.
Are you at a funeral home?
No. I don't know. No.
How are you calling me right now?
What?
If you're buried in a coffin, where are you calling from?
From a cell phone. There was an old cell phone in the coffin.
You're calling from your cell phone?
Yes. No, it's not my cell phone, but yes, I'm calling from a cell phone.
There was a cell phone in the coffin when you climbed in?
Yes. What? I didn't climb in, though.
How did you end up in the coffin, sir?
I was put here.
In the coffin?
Yes. Please help.
Now, that's one of the better phone conversations. The rest of the movie, he tries to contact this. It's the CIA, the FBI, his wife, and the kidnappers ring him and issue their demands. Now, as I'm sure everybody knows, the film plays out for the 90 minutes in the confines of that coffin, okay? And during the course of the drama, which you imagine at the beginning, how on earth are you going to string this out for 95? I mean, where are you going to go? I mean, it's a guy in a box. It is literally a guy in a box.
Is it a well-lit box?
It depends what he's using for illumination. At some point, he's using his lighter, which, of course, is running out and is using up the oxygen. He also has a panic problem. He has an anxiety problem. If he hyperventilates, his air starts to run out. There is a phone, which the power bars are going down. And once the phone runs out of power bars, he has no contact with the outside world. And he's also been given a torch, which doesn't work very well. And so all these elements, which are basically his world for the duration of the movie, are the way in which we see the world. We only see the world from the inside of his coffin and with his contact. So Firstly, the obvious thing to say is that from a writing point of view, it's very, very well written. I mean, actually, as much as it is a film about the horror of being buried alive, it is a film about the horror of being put on hold. I have yet to see a film which so brilliantly encapsulates the annoyance, the frustration, the terror, the anguish of, you know, call holding. You're connected to Cyberdyne Services.
Can it be called on hold?
It could. And it would. You remember there was that Colin Farrell movie, Phone Box, when he's in a phone box? And he can't get out because there's a sniper, right? There is a connection with that, obviously, because it is about the awfulness of dialing numbers and being put through to the wrong department and hitting answer phones and being put on, and all that. And I thought, actually, yes, if it was called On Hold, that would be half the terror of the movie, beautifully done there. And as somebody who has a difficult relationship with telephones at the best of times, that I really understood that. And there are moments of comedy in that. There are moments in which being put on hold becomes absurdly funny in a kind of blackly comic way. The other thing is that the narrative is worked out very well in terms of it's one guy having conversations with other people who you don't see, which makes you think, well, couldn't that be done as a radio play? Isn't that therefore basically an oral experience? But what's very interesting about what Rodrigo Cortez, the director, has done is he has managed to shoot the inside of a coffin from every possible angle. I mean, there is not a corner of the coffin at some point that he doesn't somehow conspire to get his camera into. And Ryan Reynolds does the best possible job of playing a guy stuck in a box in a state of panic, of anger, of sadness, of despair, all these things, whilst essentially unable to move in this tiny little space. The other thing that seems so, all those things are impressive. It's a movie which has got a political resonance to it because it turns out he's a contract worker who's in Iraq. We learn this very, very quickly. He doesn't know where he is, but he's a contract worker, and so there is a political subtext.
So when the 911 operator said, "Where are you?
Where are you?"
He never said, "I'm in Iraq."
No, he does get to that in the rest of that conversation.
Started with that, really.
No, yeah, but as they quite rightly point out, he's woken up buried alive
in Iraq.
That's not the first thing you think. I'm in Iraq. The first thing you think is, I'm buried alive.
Yeah, but when the
Ray Milland
says, "Where are you?" you might
think, he says, "I'm in a coffin," because that's
in Iraq.
Yeah, he does get to explaining that, but not immediately, because he has made the international joke. So, as a piece of writing, it's very fine, but I think it is cinematic. And hats off to the director for making it as cinematic as it is, and hats off also to Ryan Reynolds, who in the past has not been an actor who has demonstrated this kind of this range and this scope for playing a guy in a box, and during the course of being in that box, going through the full range of emotions from, you know, happiness and despair and anger and all those other things. Then, the other thing to be said about the film is, it's a film about a guy in a box for 95 minutes. And I have cards on the table time here. I have a thing about being trapped in spaces. I mean, I have a thing about being trapped in lifts. Still didn't manage to make...
Swaying grass,
puppets. Yeah. Don't like clowns. Certain fruit I'm scared of. But
what kind of fruit are you scared of?
Pomegranates. Don't like pomegranates.
What?
They look like alien fruit.
See, clowns, I understand. Lifts, I can understand. Swaying grass, I can't quite get, but there is no one else in the world who is afraid.
I bet you there's a word for it.
Pomegranates, yes. Idiot.
Idiot, yeah. Where do you stand on the buried alive issue? Is that something that freaks you out?
I hadn't really contemplated it as a likely career option.
But not as a career. Do you have a phobia about being buried alive?
Not really, no.
Okay, well, I do. And
well, don't go see the film then.
No, fine. Which is where I'm going, right? So the film opens, and it's black, and it's, you know, the last 5 minutes of The Vanishing, if you haven't seen The Vanishing, it's, you know, there's a mumblecore moment, sorry about that.
He wakes up,
and immediately I get that clammy, slightly panicky thing, I'm in a coffin, 95 minutes, going to be stuck here, and I start to get that I'm gripping the edge of the chair, and it's okay, it's fine, it's going to be all right, he's got a light, no, he's in a coffin, and I keep doing that thing.
It's just a film, Mark.
Just a film. That's exactly what I do. It's like you read my mind. What I do is I keep going to myself, it's only a movie. Ryan Reynolds. I know he's okay. Saw him on television the other night. It's Ryan Reynolds. He gets out. It's fine. It's only a movie. Look, that coffin isn't closed because the camera's in there. That means there's a hole in the wall, okay? That means he can get out. That means
he's like going with your 5-year-old kids to see the hole.
Yeah.
It's all right.
It's all right. It's only a movie. And you know what? And this part of my brain is going, it's only a movie. And this part of my brain is going, having a panic attack, got to get out, hyperventilating, going to hold James King's hand, going to run screaming from the theatre like a big old wuss, can't be dealing with. And I start doing the hyperventilating, and I have to go, okay, calm down. I look away from the screen and I gather myself, get to a movie. Ryan Reynolds, not worried about it. Look up. He's still in the box. All starts happening. I swear to you, I spent the duration of the movie, like my fingernails digging into the seat. And afterwards, I came out, and David will attest to this because I had to walk down
David?
The road. David Braithwaite, you know him. I mention him almost every show.
I know, but no one else knows who he is apart from his family. And people who
regular listeners who have heard this show before will know that when I say David, I mean David Braithwaite. And we walked down the road together, and David will, you can shake his head in agreement with this. I kept going, blimey, Charlie, or words. The language that I used would have got me a 15 certificate in the same way as Made in Dagenham has a 15 certificate, and probably entirely appropriately so. I mean, it gets the very best out of that situation. It's very well directed. It's very well written. And if you are like me, somebody who has a claustrophobic view of this kind of thing, I mean, and James King, for the first time ever in a horror movie, was looking at me going, what's with you?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Do you not have a fear of closed spaces?
Can I refer you to the... when you asked me that just about 3 minutes ago...
And you said no.
And I said no. Pretty much the same kind of art. I haven't just developed one.
All right. If you're going to be sarky about it.
And pomegranates, just to put it in some kind of perspective. Pomegranates. Has there been a movie in which there's been some serious pomegranate action, which you've gone, oh, well, you know, I'm having... It's a pomegranate. No, just...
The worst movie would be waking up buried in a coffin with a pomegranate and a clown.
With some grass. TJ Porter, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to disagree with all this hype for Buried. I saw this at Frightfest. I thought it was the most pretentious, self-indulgent piece of tripe I've seen. This movie, I'm surprised, isn't sponsored by BlackBerry, the shameless promotional plugging. It's a sad day in narrative history. Ryan Reynolds is the only saving grace for this movie.
It's the only thing in the movie. But the only saving grace. He's in the... Sorry.
Thank you for interrupting. But the messages this film conveys are old and tired. Capitalism, a Love Story, does a better job in some of these areas. It's pants. Jackie in Cardiff. I went to see Buried last night. Came out of the cinema an emotional wreck. It's testament
She's my girl.
To Rodrigo Cortez's direction and Ryan Reynolds' acting that I was completely engrossed from start to finish, including the times when there was just a black screen with the sound of a man freaking out and breathing heavily. To never leave the coffin once during the whole movie was original, brave, and proved to be an excellent piece of direction. Amazing stuff. If you too are afraid of a pomegranate, the BBC helpline.
Are you too afraid of pomegranates?
They almost certainly are. In fact, it's the next album, is what they're going to call it. They've done Lemon, now they can do the pomegranate. In fact, that could be their next staging device. They had that fantastic 360-degree experience, which their main man, Willie Williams, designed. Next time, mate, it's got to be a pomegranate, a movable pomegranate that opens and Bono springs out in 3D. What do you think?
I think that is my nightmare come true.
321. Apparently, there is a pomegranate film festival every year in Toronto. No. And guess what?
You're making this up.
I'm not. We're going.
Are we?
What time of year is it? What time is a good time to go to Toronto? The Pomegranate Film Festival sounds like a good booking. There is no issue at all about money in the BBC. They will happily pay for us to go to that. And there's a film in 2005 called Pomegranate. Unfortunately, the Pomegranate Film Festival in Toronto is in September, so we've missed it. But next year.
Gosh darn.
There's a movie came out 5 years ago called Pomegranate, 95 minutes. The story is two cousins who were best friends as boys in Beirut reunite in Los Angeles 17 years later. I imagine other things happen, but that appears to be a plot synopsis.
Do they get stuck in a box with mobile phone and a clown?
I don't think so. Okay, Stephen Woolley's going to be with us, I would think, after 3:30.
Okay.
He's in the vicinity of the studio.
Can I?
What else is new?
Shall I give you a little bit? I'll tell you what we should discuss is, because we have a clip of it and I'd like to do this.
Apparently we can say hello to Stephen Woolley.
Hello to Stephen Woolley.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Simon. Lovely to hear from you both.
Well, it's very nice of you to join us. How are you, Stephen?
I'm very, very well. I was just shouted at by a security man trying to get in, but other than that...
The security man was trying to get in?
No, he was shouting at me because I drove past him without
You drove past
off.
Him? Well, you should...
Yes.
Wow.
It was a BBC, and a BBC man was very upset with me.
Okay, how did you get out of that?
Somebody came to rescue me.
Do you have any phobias, Steve? I don't know. Mark is apparently not just afraid of clowns and lifts, he's also afraid of pomegranates.
You know what? I don't like flying very much.
That's not a phobia. That's a legitimate fear.
Which is a fear, yes. I don't have a fear of flying. I have a fear of crashing.
We're talking about irrational fears, I think.
Nothing irrational fears? No, nothing I can think of off the top of my head. But I'll keep thinking.
Right.
No,
well,
nothing too irrational.
Okay. Look, why didn't you? We want to give you some proper time. Okay, to deal with these issues. which have been raised by your article today, in Mark's favourite left-leaning paper.
What, Fangoria?
Exactly. We'll be talking to Stephen about that and do some more Dagenham stuff, but you can fit something in probably just before the news.
OK, Mark Cousins came on the show recently to talk about the thing he made, his first movie, in which he goes to this village, Kuptapa, in which there are kids who have never seen a movie before, and he takes out a cinema screen, he shows them a bunch of kids' movies, very interesting road kids' movies, and then he gives them cameras to film their own stories, and in doing so he sees what, you know, these kind of extraordinary visions of people who've not au fait with cinema finding out for themselves what cinema's like. And what I said when Mark came on was one of the things I really liked about the film, which I think did win an award quite recently, was that, as with so much of Mark Cousins' work, I mean, he's a critic, but he's also a filmmaker. I mean, he's funny. He described himself as primarily a critic. I would think of him as primarily a filmmaker. It's narrated by Mark, who has this very particular lyrical, lilting-sounding voice. And I said that actually, much more than a documentary, it is like a lyrical visual poem. Anyway, we have a clip which kind of demonstrates what I was trying to talk about. We didn't have a clip last week. So here's a clip from the first movie, which is playing at a selected group of cinemas. I think Mark said it's playing, like, you know, one or two performances at each and, you know, doing the rounds. It's a really magical piece. Here's a clip.
I imagine that it's not me here, but the wee tenderized Belfast boy that I once was. And so I see the Fifth Land through the eyes of kids like him. The boy sees a cactus. An orange palm tree. A horse, a dinosaur, we go here, the boy notices the man at the bottom left of this image, they could smelt nations here.
Now you see, my feeling about that is that that has...
That's very misleading.
Why is that misleading?
Because people will listen to that and think, oh, I don't know, this doesn't sound like a great film. But in the context of the images which that voiceover goes with, it makes more sense.
With which that voiceover goes, it makes more sense. I actually disagree. I think in the same way as you said it was misleading when we played a clip of Terence Davis's Of Time and the City, which Mark's narration in this film does remind me of. It's essentially, it's a poetic narration. It's intensely personal. He talks time and again about the idea that he's a kid who grew up in what was on some level a war zone in his, you know, from his childhood in Ireland, and he compares this, you know, albeit sensitively, with the experience of these kids who have lived through the most unbelievable atrocities, and he attempts to see the world through their eyes, and he describes the camera as being basically an empathy machine. It seems to me that the thing that underwrites all of Mark Cousins' work is that he's a genuine cinema lover. He's a person who understands the transcendent and genuinely magical power of cinema. And I think that listening to that voice, listening to the way he talks, listening to the completely unabashed poetry of it is enchanting. It's interesting that you should say that without the images, you don't feel the same. That probably demonstrates that his movie making is correct, that you need to see it as well. You see, when I hear that, I see the film in my head, the film that I saw, the film that we showed at the Shetland Film Festival, the film that I did find genuinely enchanting. I mean, it may be that it's not for everyone.
I think it's an idiosyncratic voiceover, and it was the right, you know, a narration.
Sure.
Correct. And makes sense in the context once you've seen the film.
Okay.
I think just taken as a piece of audio, people might have thought, this sounds a little bit strange.
Okay, but I think the whole film has that kind of tone. In order to demonstrate that this is not just me as a sort of as a film bore saying I like this because this is a work by somebody else from your point of view, as an ignoramus, you enjoyed the film, didn't you?
It's amazing how I've managed to stay so ignorant
after 10 years of entertainment.
Just as ignorant as when I started.
And your feeling about it was what?
No, I enjoyed it because the kids are utterly terrific,
yeah,
and they do have an extraordinary story to tell. And as we mentioned with Mark Cousins last week, they get their parents and grandparents to tell the story the terrible things that have happened in a way that, you know, if it had been Mark there, would have taken him days to sort of get them into his confidence and so on. So instantly they're in and they're making these films and getting stories that he wouldn't have got.
Yeah, and I think just as a piece, as a meditation on the nature of cinema and on the magical power of cinema, it's really something.
Though I still think showing them the singing ringing tree as well, their first childhood.
That's
right,
that's the other thing I'm scared of, is the singing ringing tree.
Yeah. Stephen Woolley, did you see the singing ringing tree when you were a kid?
I remember it when I was a kid, yeah.
Would you have really, shown it to a bunch of kids who had never seen the film before?
I thought it was one of the scariest things I've ever seen in my life.
Exactly.
It freaked me out completely.
Yeah. Mark chose it as one of the
Mark
films.
Cousins.
Mark Cousins, yes. To show to these these kids. And that and E.T.
E.T., yeah.
And what were the other films?
It was the Boot, Red Balloon.
E.T.'s fine. Red Balloon is beautiful.
Yeah, but there are moments in E.T. which are, I mean, I have a vision of our family sitting on the sofa. I'm going, look, you're going to love this. And then 2 hours later, wah! You know, total floods of tears and anguish.
So in the next half...
I'll be right.
I actually saw E.T. with Sam Raimi at the Cannes Film Festival. It's the opening night. It was the closing night film. And they wouldn't let me in because my suit was the wrong colour. And Sam had to argue vociferously on my behalf, and he was relentless and actually melted the French security guys down, so they let me in.
What colour was your
suit? My memory. It was blue, but second can. I thought a blue suit would be all right.
There's something going on between you and security guards, isn't there?
I know. Me and bouncers.
Alistair in Glasgow, first of all, I just wanted to pick up the good doctor's comment about Scott Pilgrim to make a more general point. This is a point you made last week.
Doc?
Dr. K correctly points out that it hasn't done all that well in terms of ticket sales. Mm. However, does that necessarily mean that hasn't done that well in a more general sense? A vastly superior number of people might have gone to see Dinner for Schmucks and Eat, Pray, Love. But surely a huge proportion of this number were hugely disappointed by those films. Whilst fewer people have seen Scott Pilgrim, is the net level enjoyment not actually higher than that of films which have done better at the box office?
My own a non-indicative poll of what people have thought about Scott Pilgrim is that it's really divided the people who have gone to see it. I've seen loads and loads of tweets from people who saw it and loved it, loads of tweets from people who saw it and hated it. It's a real kind of, you know, down-the-middle thing. I do agree that just because loads of people go and see films, a film doesn't mean they're enjoying it. I mean, I advise, look at, you know, Sex and the City 2 or Pirates of the Caribbean 3 at World's End. Loads of people saw it doesn't mean loads of people enjoyed it. I think loads of people were disappointed by it. So it's a valid point, but actually I think in the case of Scott Pilgrim, it is a film which has divided even those people who have been to see it. I liked it, but even as I liked it, I understood that it wasn't for everyone.
Should we talk about Dagenham again?
Yes. Well, the situation is that the Made in Dagenham has a 15 certificate from the BBFC. It contains, and Stephen will correct me if I'm wrong here, Stephen Woolley, the producer, it has something like 15 or 16 uses of the F word. The BBFC therefore have ruled that it should be a 15 certificate. Stephen is of the belief that...
Well, let's find out, shall we?
Oh, I'm sorry, you were throwing to me. I thought you were sort of saying, you do the filling.
I
don't want
you to actually tell Stephen what he thinks.
Fine, well, in that case, I'll just be quiet and you run the show for
me. Hello, Stephen, what do you think about that?
Hi, guys. I can't work out when I'm mic'd up or not.
You're mic'd up now, so tread carefully.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. A few things. I thought Kick-Ass was a more superior film to Scott Pilgrim. I think it did... That got that combination of the violence and the comic strip so right.
I like Kick-Ass very much.
And it was mentioned this morning in the article I wrote, and I just want to say what a great film I think Kick-Ass is, because they subbed my marvellous Kick-Ass to just Kick-Ass. So I just want to say that, just to get the record straight, I think it's a lovely film.
It is.
A really brilliant adaptation of a comic strip. I think one of the few really successful ones. What were we talking about? Oh, the certification.
Your film.
Yeah, I mean, Made in Dagenham was a real labour of love for me and my producing partner, Elizabeth Carlson. We spent 4 years working on the script, and when we finally got a good enough script, we'd cast Sally and got our wonderful director Nigel Cole on board, and then the cast were incredible because they all said yes. Bob Hoskins was our first choice, Ros Pike was our first choice, Miranda Richardson was our first choice. It was incredible. We just had an amazing cast, and they all just said yes, and they all loved the script. And so we made the film. Billy wrote a lovely script set in 1968 on a factory floor. And one of the things that we loved about it, having three daughters myself, was that making a film about empowering women, I think, is an important thing. And it's also important that you allow young women to see a film like this. I'm not saying that there's a huge crowd of 13 or 14-year-old girls out there desperate to see Made in Dagenham. But why ban it from them for the sake of the fact that we were very clearly trying to be realistic about the way people spoke on a factory floor, and that included a lot of the use of the word F in a very, in the swear word F, I should say.
Yes, we're there on that.
Yeah, in a very casual way, in the way that people spoke. I mean, I was brought up in Islington, and you know, my family, a lot of them worked in factories, and I had three very strong aunts and a very, very vociferously strong nan, my grandmother, who could turn the air blue. That was how people spoke in those days, and to this day, I'm sure on factory floors across the world, people use it almost like a punctuation mark. Of course, films made in 1968 couldn't use the word because at that time, you know, you really couldn't get away with anything in terms of films. But these days, the word is used quite liberally in lots of movies. But I was really shocked that we got a 15 certificate.
Why?
The word is so casually used in the context of the film, which has
not
no
in 12
violence.
Certificate movies.
Well,
you must have known, Steve. Come on, you
No, I really didn't. So I really, really, honestly.
Can you name any other 12 certificate film which has got lots of hard swearing?
Scott Pilgrim has got the F word. One sequence in the middle of Scott Pilgrim where they use the F word at least 30 times, but they bleep it. But you hear the F and you hear the K. So
yeah,
bleeping,
but crucially,
is worse for me. Bleeping is worse for me than actually hearing the word, especially in the context of a non-sexual, non-violent, and that's very, very important,
but
a non-violent manner.
Surely you must have known that with that amount of swearing in it, it was going to get a 15. I mean, it's just...
Go and see the movie. We've had so many screenings where I've asked audiences after, what did you think of the swearing in the film or the bad language? And they just look at you like you're crazy. What bad language? It's used in such a way that you don't even know it's there. I had no idea.
But rules is rules, presumably.
I had no idea we had more than five. I mean, you know, the censor said, well, if you've got a handful, well, it will give you a 12A. And then they counted them up, and it came to, I think actually more than 15. And I didn't really, honestly, truly did not notice as we were filming the film, as we were editing the movie, that there was such a proliferation because when Bob Hoskins or Andrew Riseborough or Sally Hawkins uses the word, it's seamless. It's why the film, I think, is a good example of a movie that can match something that's realistic with something which is almost dreamlike, that they actually win this battle, and they win it as ordinary, extraordinary people. They're ordinary people who are extraordinary, and that's what I think the big message of the film is. As ordinary people can do extraordinary things, and I think that's a great message, and as ordinary people, they use that word.
But here's the
thing. As you both do, I'm sure.
Here's the thing. Firstly, I think, I love the film, I think it's great. And as I've said now on the record, I would be happy for my 12-year-old daughter to see it. Well, she's not quite 12 yet, so I'll wait until she's 12. But here, I think that the thing that Simon's raising, and I understand entirely, is that the BBFC policy is you can have a handful and you can get away with it. But you can't have 16 or 17. And the reason is, from their consultation with the public, that at that level, parents will complain to them. Now, I think the interesting question here is, when Simon asked me earlier on in the show, do you think their judgment is right? What I said was, I would show it to my daughter, but I understand that other people would not want to do that, for exactly because, oddly enough, in this day and age, the thing that the BBFC get more complaints about than almost anything is swearing. So the question is, you must have been given the option of taking them out. You must have been given the option of dubbing.
Well, we have the option of taking them out, but it would have been crazy. It would have been denying the truth of the film. And I'm not going to start taking out like 15 F words and to have a 12A. I mean, the point of this movie is that we wanted as wide an audience to see it as possible. And we don't really want to doctor the movie. That would be really... I mean, I've never done it before. I refuse to take Ralph Fiennes' buttocks out of End of the Affair for the sake of...
Which got you an 18 rather than a 15.
Yeah, and they changed the law after that. They said to me, the censor said, you know, if you submitted the film now, it would get a 15 straight away. Actually, it might even get a 12A these days because the censorship has changed so much and there's not a single swear word in it. No, I think the thing that really gets my goat, I suppose, a little bit, is that everything should be taken in context. You can't simply say if you have five nipple shots or if you have two buttock shots, you're going to get a 15 or a 12 or an 18. It's crazy. Everything should be in context. When we made Michael Collins, the censor in Ireland showed the film, as I've done with Maiden Dagenham. He showed it to politicians, they showed it to schools, they showed it to magistrates, and decided that Michael Collins was a very important film because it told a part of history that that he felt Irish kids should know, and they gave it a U certificate. And that was because the censor felt that the film should have the widest possible audience. That's the film censor. If a censor can have an opinion, then that's not a bad thing. I do agree that if you're going to have the F word used in either an explicitly sexual manner or an explicitly violent manner, then absolutely it should be a 15. In the same way that in the film that we've just praised, in the context of Scott Pilgrim, which is Kick-Ass, that film, you know, should have a 15. It has a lot of swearing and in particular associated with violence. I think swearing associated with violence, yes, but swearing is a commonplace, natural thing that Chaucer would have done, or Lily Allen might be singing songs about.
Yeah, but it gets dropped when Lily Allen has a record played
only
on the radio.
Only in this country.
When a Lily Allen record is played on the radio, it sounds like there's something wrong with your radio. And I mean, that's
yeah,
how it...
Yeah, it's ridiculous. France, Spain, they just play it on the radio. Nobody
But we're in the UK, and the bit I can't quite get my finger on is the fact that director, writer, producer didn't realise that with that amount of the F word, it was going to get a 15. It was just
no, we didn't. Actually, seriously,
obvious.
Simon, we seriously don't sit around discussing the BBFC when we're writing scripts or when we're shooting films. It only comes at the last minute, and it was a bit of a blind spot that this happened.
Julie in Ipswich, on this text, Dean, my daughter is 12 next month. She's only just left primary school. I'm not a prude by any measure, but I wouldn't want her seeing a film littered with very strong swearing. There's enough time for that for her to deal with it when she's older.
I think she should go and see the film, and then...
But she can't go and see the film, Stephen, because it's a 15.
No, the mother should go and see the film.
Oh, I see, sorry.
And then text you back and let you know whether or not she should be allowed to take her daughter. Because I have not yet a single parent that has seen this film and wouldn't want to take their 13-year-old.
Stephen, we appreciate you making a very perilous journey into the studio on a pretty horrendous day for the weather and all that kind of stuff, and appreciate you coming and talking to us, Stephen. Thank you, as ever. Hugh Trimble writes, I wonder if the Doc will have a chance to say a few words on the 25th anniversary re-release of Back to the Future.
Yes.
This week. Easily my best-loved film of all time, which I can't wait to see remastered on the big screen. I have particularly fond, if hazy, memories of student days when a group of us formed the Dr. Emmett L. Brown Society of New College, Oxford. Sorry, Mark, he says in brackets. Better known as DocSoc.
DocSoc.
And would hold regular DocSoc Marty meetings, which involved, this is the game, watching the entire trilogy over an evening, with half the room drinking fizzy pop every time Marty yells Doc, the other half drinking fizzy pop every time Doc yells Marty, and the entire room drinking a whole glass of fizzy pop every time either character said Great Scott! Needless to say, plenty of our friends know they must have seen part three several times, but couldn't tell you what happens in it at all. Now, that's an interesting game.
Part three has a special place in my heart because when I was first writing for the monthly film bulletin, which became Sight and Sound, one of the things you had to do for that is to write a synopsis of the film. And I wrote a synopsis of Back to the Future 3, which it's a tough movie to synopsize in like 300 words. And I was very proud to find out that later on my synopsis of the film was used as an exemplary synopsis. The review they thought was rubbish, but they thought, boy, that's a good synopsis. I was very proud of that.
Good. Well, thank you for that entertaining anecdote.
Did you change the fizzy pop?
That's what it says.
It did say fizzy pop.
He says fizzy pop, so who are we to disagree?
Fine.
But apparently, if you drink lots of fizzy pop, you forget things. Clearly, would be the message from Hugh. Okay, so what else is new?
Little Big Soldier, which is the new movie starring Jackie Chan, of whom I am a fan, officially set in the war period in China between 476 BC and 221 BC. Jackie Chan plays a farmer who's conscripted to the Liang army, and at the beginning of the film, in their fight against the Wei dynasty, at the beginning of the film, there's a battle and from which he emerges as the only survivor, and he then takes as his prisoner, although it's the loosest possible term of a prisoner, the general of the opposing army, who he is then going to take back to his home in order to claim a big reward. So it's an odd couple movie. They have to go on a quest, they have to get across stuff together, and during the course of it, do you think there's any possibility that they'll sort out their differences and learn to love each other? Because, hey, we're all a bit, aren't we? Maybe. And obviously there will be martial arts fighting. Well, we are. Yes, we are. We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving. I think that's what they said anyway. And so essentially it's you know, it's a late period Jackie Chan historic period action comedy in the way that, you know, Jackie Chan has made his own. I mean, I think Jackie Chan's a really likable screen presence, and there are many films which I've seen with him in them in which I thought he's actually the best thing in the film. The film itself can be slightly ropey. This is interesting because it's a movie which, you know, it's visually very lovely to watch. It has these kind of, you know, panoramic landscapes. It has huge big battle sequences. It has martial arts sequences, which, as in all those things, you enjoy watching the martial arts sequences, knowing that when you get to the end of the movie, there'll be the reel of outtakes in which they do the same stunts but fall over and hit each other in the head with sticks, because that's what, because in the Jackie Chan movies they tend to actually do the stunts, and Jackie Chan himself, and Jackie Chan I think now is in his mid-50s, but I mean it's not by any means a masterpiece, but it is proof of his understanding of physical comedy, of his understanding of, you know, what's necessary to be a, you know, a screen actor, which is, I mean, you know, if you see things recently, like the English language movies, which he's done, I mean, his command of the English language on screen has got better and better, but he's never going to be Laurence Olivier. But he's somebody who manages to communicate physically, because in this, he's not having to do the translation problem, but he is still essentially primarily a physical actor. And I could just watch Jackie Chan doing this kind of stuff for ages and ages. It's a 15 certificate movie. It was cut by the BBFC. I mentioned this only in passing. It was cut to remove a cruel and potentially harmful horse trip in which a horse has its legs pulled from underneath it. And I must say that once again,
can you not do that in a 15?
You can't do it at all. The BBFC are very strict on this.
So it was a real horse trip. I mean, it wasn't just something.
Said what appeared to be a real horse trip. I don't know the background of it, but the phrase that they use is to move a cruel and potentially harmful horse trip. The BBFC do very, very strictly monitor animal action in movies, and if there are certain ways that a horse can fall that won't hurt it, certain ways the horse can fall that will hurt it. And the way it works here is if you don't do the former, you do the latter, then the thing comes out, and that's the beginning end of that. That aside, and congratulations to the BBFC on that decision, I think Little Big Soldier was, you know, entertaining fun, which I liked watching Jackie Chan, but so much of it to do with his screen presence. Takers is a heist movie in which a group of people get together to pull off an Italian Job style heist, to which they have been put up by an estranged member who has recently served some time in the chokey hole, has now come out and has come to the media and said, I've got a job. They're wondering whether or not this would be a good idea. Here's a clip.
He's standing there, he's drinking my whiskey. I was going to shoot him in the back of his head.
Should have shot him. The guy's been out 24 hours, already wants to do a job. He's crazy.
Yeah, Ghost doesn't play when it comes to money. He's too smart for that.
Sure. He's clever, not smart.
Guys, we always wait at least a year between jobs. There's a reason for that.
Gordon, you guys go way back, right? Think he's being straight up?
Ghost could have ratted us out a long time ago, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. Kept his word.
What's to stop him from doing exactly that once we give him his cut from 04?
See, that's the problem. Yeah. That's a big problem,
man. Something ain't right. I don't trust him.
Relax.
Dude's trouble. I think he's on to something, though.
Film features, amongst others, the marvellous acting talents of Hayden Christensen, formerly Anakin, you are...
3D Skywalker.
Of course. We're going to get Hayden Christensen in 3D, aren't we?
And someone was emailing earlier saying, is my interest in seeing Star Wars in 3D slightly tempered by the fact that Phantom Menace will be the first one?
Yes, it will.
Which, of course, is correct.
Jar Jar Binks. Yeah. Okay, fine. So cast also includes Jay Hernandez, Idris Elba, Paul Walker, and Matt Dillon as the cop who has the thing in his head that he wants to bring, you know, he's going to be the guy that brings these people to justice. He's sort of tortured. He's torn between his work and his private life. The film begins with the sequence in which he's meant to be picking his daughter up to take her for a day to see the sights, but in fact what he does is he ends up tailing these people who he thinks might be involved in a potential. So it's got a number of things going on in it. It has action sequences. It's loud and shouty. And I think the most remarkable thing about it is that it's completely forgettable. I saw it 4 days ago now. We're Friday. And almost all memory of it has been expunged, except for the fact that these people are in it. It's a heist movie. They do a heist. He needs to bring them down. There are massive shootouts, and that's it. And I think it is important when you... It's very difficult to make a heist movie work really well and be, you know, intellectually stimulating and action-packed as well. And people say, well, don't bring those sort of things to it. It's just meant to be an action-packed, you know, comedy... not comedy, an action-packed thriller romp. Well, actually, the things that are the most action-packed are when you really care about the people, you really care about the characters, you really care about the situations. I have to say that none of those things applied here. It is from my already fading memory of it, a movie in which it goes there, that bit, do that, run around, that, him, the end.
Can I mention... you finished?
I am now.
Okay, good. Next week we're doing one of our little cinema trips. Are we not?
We are. We're going to the Phoenix in East Finchley, which is recently reopened on its centenary reopening.
And this is where there's your big flappy hand is stuck in the concrete just outside and people fall in and never seen again.
That is right. It's a very small print, but thank you for saying that it's my big flappy hand. Yes.
So guests next Friday on this programme, Aaron Sorkin. How exciting is that?
Is that confirmed?
I don't know. Yes.
It is.
It
great.
Is. Aaron Sorkin, who wrote The Social Network and also The West Wing, of course. And I'll try and remember to speak more about The Social Network than West Wing, even though what I really want to
But you've seen Social Network, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think?
Which I think is terrific. Most entertaining and very wordy in an Aaron Sorkin kind of way, and all the better for it.
Do you think it's as good as Hackers?
It's completely different than Hackers. Just because it's got computers in it doesn't make it similar in any way to Hackers.
Very hard to top Hackers.
And also Guillermo del Toro is going to be on the programme next week.
He is.
So that makes it quite a good couple of hours, I would have thought.
And I was going to say, how can people apply for tickets? But I believe there's no point in applying for tickets anymore, is there? Aren't they all...
Say again.
You're not listening.
I've got so many things happening.
I was going to tell people how they can apply for tickets, but I believe there's no point in applying for tickets because they're
all gone.
They've all gone.
Yes.
Well,
Stephen
Redding.
Why
did you mention it then?
I always get bored listening to you two because I'm not really into films. But today, presumably because you're filling in, you're much more entertaining. Perhaps you should go into warming up theatre audiences.
Actually, there is a thing in there. Can I say very quickly, there's a film out called Collapse, which is a documentary which a guy called Rupert, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, talks about how the world is in a state of inevitable collapse. He is a retired cop who's also done lots of stuff about how we've reached peak oil and how everything's going to fall apart. And it's one of those films in which all that happens is this guy talks at you for 90 minutes about the coming catastrophe. And I think his thesis is interesting. He's a strange character. I'm not sure what it's doing in a cinema. I don't think it's a cinematic release.
So we'll be with John in just a moment. However, movie of the week.
Well, Made in Dagenham. I mean, I really, really like it. It's a really entertaining, good, solid film. And I actually think that it's going to do well internationally. That said, my record on predicting these kind of things is notoriously poor.
And that's the end of this week's podcast. Can I thank you for staying not just to the end of everything that we did, but it's like staying beyond the credits.
Because we didn't think we were going to get... Yeah, exactly.
Because I think most people would have switched off, you know, probably about 5-10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for staying here. I think we're okay today. Really.
And for those people who have stayed beyond the credits, here's your little beyond the credits treat.
Yes.
Is that we did discover during the course of the programme that the BBFC rating for Buried does not say sustained death, sustained threat.
Yeah, which is kind of slightly more believable, but not as funny.
No. So let's stick with sustained death.
And next week, we're going to be at the Phoenix, your favourite place in Finchley, with, as I think we've mentioned, special guests Guillermo del Toro and Aaron Sorkin.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.